Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track by track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Let Go by Epic and Snatched Up by Interscope Records. Could Unwritten Law have been one of the punk bands of the 90s to really explode? How would things have been different if Kaylin had been the first single? Welcome to the Talking Records Podcast, where we're going to be diving into Unwritten Law's self-titled album. My name is Jed, and I'm here with my very good friend, Wayne. Hey, Wayne, what's going on?
Hey, what's going on, Jed? Thanks for having me back again.
Welcome back. I'm going to keep having you back if you keep saying yes.
Hooray! That's good. I'm waiting for the spin-off metal album segments that you're going to be doing.
Yeah. Do I have to diversify? I feel like I have to diversify, huh? Can't just be doing punk records.
I'm just wondering if you have any.
Well, you'll be my man. I'll call you up.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back to the podcast, Wayne. I'm super excited to have you here. Roommate, bandmate, good friend. We logged a lot of listening hours on Unwritten Law.
Oh, yeah. It was like, I mean, that era when it came out, it was just like, it was always on.
So my question is, why didn't Unwritten Law explode, do you think?
Oh, man.
You know, they were on the majors, but they weren't one of the big names.
Yeah, and I don't know. They did all the right things. They were like that era as well. They were like the Warped Tour. They were seen with the right bands. Like I don't know. They went out with like Blink-182. They went out with, I don't even know, like pretty much every band that did make it. And this was a super solid album, as far as I know. I recording wise, it seemed like they did a lot of extra studio work, just like on the songs themselves while they were laying the tracks down and stuff. It seemed like, you know, it wasn't just like a quick push it out type of thing. And I mean, that's definitely kind of like their thing of how they operate on albums, I think. I mean, like, you know, looking at their discography, I guess they had like a good run where they did an album every year or every other year, but I think that was only like three albums. And before and after that, it was like one every 5 to 8 years. I was like, wow. But going back to your question, I have no idea why they didn't hit it big or just more recognizable. Or I mean, it feels like they hit on just like all of the popular stuff of that era and that genre.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what it was. It was too much of the same. Maybe. I feel like they were kind of earlier on the curve. So I don't want to say they were pioneers of it or anything, but they were definitely like very early on in all of those, I don't know, trends in like the pop punk and like that type of scene thing. But yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a mystery.
We'll talk about it because even on this album, I feel like they're starting to branch, you know, and then by the time they get into their follow-up albums, they definitely started to break away from like that 90s Epitaph fat style punk. But yeah, you know, a question that's always kind of, I won't say haunted me, but I've always been sort of curious, how come Unwritten Law wasn't the big names? I mean, they were a pretty big name. I mean, when they had Seeing Red out and all those songs from Elva, they got pretty well known, but they were never, you know, Offspring, Blink-182 level. Which is interesting because they just as well could have been.
It seems like that, yeah. Definitely seems that way.
Make sure you check out the Talking Records podcast on all social media platforms. We can be found by... Okay, seriously. Is there any real point in saying this? Please rate and subscribe. Hit the bell for notifications. Has anyone really ever done this as if the idea hadn't occurred until someone told them to do it? Please. If you want to support Talking Records, please listen to the show. If you really want to support the podcast, tell a friend. Tell two friends. We simply ask that you support the show by spreading it around and interacting with us on social media, because that's really what it's about. connecting over great music, and focusing on a passion we all share. Thank you so much for your support. All right, let's get on with it. Today, we are going to be talking about Unwritten Law's self-titled record, or The Black Album. The record was released on June 2nd, 1998 on Interscope Records and was produced by Rick Parashar. The album was recorded at London Bridge Studio, which Parashar founded in Seattle. It became a very popular place for Seattle grunge bands to record. These include multi-platinum releases for Temple of the Dog, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Blind Melon, Dinosaur Jr. I mean, so this like studio and this guy was like, you know, the center of grunge rock in the 90s.
Yeah, that's cool. And I mean, this album came out in 98.
Yeah.
So maybe that was a little past that heyday, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he definitely knew what he was doing. I mean, like, it shows throughout the album. Like, he definitely, like, put it together pretty smoothly, I guess I want to say. It's like, all the transitions are really kind of clever, and it seems like it's well thought out.
His production is definitely noticeable.
Yeah.
The band had been on Epic Records, where their 1996 record Oz Factor was released. The band had wanted better distribution, and Epic was maybe looking to have, you know, their punk band in the midst of that bit of fire that the genre caught in the mid-late 90s. But, you know, the two singles didn't do much, and Unwritten Law didn't catch on, like some of the other major label punk bands. We talked about that. When it came time to release another record, Epic didn't seem to care. Scott Russo, vocalist, explained, "They never even heard the new record. After that, we didn't know if we wanted to go back to an independent label or just try to find another major. Interscope Records came in right away and genuinely showed a love for the record. It made sense to go with them." And by Interscope, I think he means Tom Wally, the executive that brought them in. Because after Wally's departure, the band also left the label. So it's like, you know, when you have that like one guy who like signs your band and he's like in your corner and he speaks up for you at the label meetings and stuff, but then he's gone and the label's like, who are you?
Right. As soon as that guy left, they were out of there too. Yeah.
But isn't it funny though that these majors were just, they were reaching for, you know, whatever would stick. And interesting that Epic went with Unwritten Law. They didn't really catch on with Oz Factor, and they were just kind of like, okay, you know, bye. But they were extremely lucky to land at Interscope next. I mean, they could have easily kind of crawled back to an indie and gone that route. You know, had the one record out on a major and then went back to the indies. But the fact that they were able to quickly move to another major label is pretty impressive when you think about it.
Oh, it is. Yeah, from one big label to another. But I mean, I don't know what would happen if they did go back to a smaller label on this Black Album. I don't know, you know, from their perspective of how many songs were written, if they would have been the same at all, or like if it would have been the same album. I don't think so. I mean, you know, maybe they would have some of the same songs, but I don't think, you know, a smaller label would have had maybe they would have given the time in the studio, but I don't know if the quality was there. You know, I don't know if these guys are really, it's hard to tell. I mean, it varies so much from band to band as to like how much they're really involved in the production. And then some are just like, you know, just come in with some songs and that's it. And, you know, they got to do some magic on the production end.
Right.
Or if they have like a vision, you know, for all of the production to be like, here's the songs, but we want to do this and this and this and this and this and this and this. I don't know. So if they were on a smaller label, I don't know. I don't know if they would have came out with the same album.
And what's not really clear, because there is very limited information about the recording of this record on the internet, is that, you know, when he says they hadn't heard the record, I don't know if he's talking about demos or if they actually already had the full Rick Parashar recording done. That's not really clear to me. Or if they landed at Interscope, then they recorded, like, did Interscope pay for Parashar services or what? So that all that's a little murky. If they'd gone back to an indie, could they have afforded that?
Oh yeah, I don't think so. Was he did he have anything to do with them on any other albums
I
or
don't think
something?
so.
Or they just like linked him up with him? They were just like, hey, yeah, you're gonna go do this with this guy.
Not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a lot of available information out there on this album, which is a
No.
bummer because this is a good album. It's a solid album.
Yeah. We'll have to piece it together as we go. One thing of note that is interesting is during this time, bassist John Bell had left the band, and pivot bassist Micah Albao joined them in Seattle for the recording of their self-titled record. So, kind of cool. Pivot bassist plays on one record, fill-in guy.
They've had so many members. Like I got lost in the shuffle and stuff. I did a quick glance at their their members and stuff like that. But
At the record's completion, I know they picked up Pat PK Kim. He joined in on the band, but he actually didn't record on this record. He did all the touring and remained with the band for many follow-up albums before his eventual departure. But the album was recorded late summer of 97 at London Bridge, as I mentioned. And then in September of 97, headed over to Studio West, maybe to finish up some overdubs or lay vocals down. And that's basically it. I mean, that, as far as information goes, is all I was able to dig up on the Black record. So let's jump into how you got into this record, Wayne. Tell me the story of how you got into Unwritten Law, because when I found Unwritten Law in your CD booklet, I was surprised.
I think it was the same way I found a lot of music in that genre. It was just working at that place in the mall that I was at for a decade or so, working at the Hot Topic.
Ooh, yeah.
So at that point in time, you got to listen to whatever the heck you wanted to, and they let you play whatever you wanted and gave you a bunch of suggestions and stuff, but you could play whatever you wanted in their master mix and stuff. So this album was just constantly on rotation over there, not by default, but I think it's by choice of, a lot of the other employees that were there. It was the same thing. I was just happened to be listening to it, and little by little, I memorized the whole album. And I was like, what? I think I like it. Maybe I should buy it. I ended up buying it and stuff. And still listen to it plenty. I mean, like probably like for a decade after it came out, still kind of, put it on, and it had, I don't know, like a lot of variety on that album. And for a punk rock album to be that long, it was like, wow, there's a lot of material on here. It's just so not like most things that were coming out in that era. It was like, Blink-182 albums were like, 25 minutes or something like that, and theirs was almost twice as long or something like that.
Comes in at a whopping 45 minutes. That's of course, if you count the time between the last track and the secret track, but 45 minutes.
That's a lot. Maybe that's what it was too. Maybe people's attention span couldn't be bothered with songs that were over 3 minutes.
You might be onto something, Wayne.
Maybe.
So you were mostly into like hardcore metal though. So what was it about this record? You
It
said
was
you liked
just
the
super catchy. It was
diversity.
like, it had like enough variety so that like it could keep you entertained. It was almost like hitting the mix on like a couple of different bands all in the same album. But had the continuity to it to like know that you were listening to the same band style-wise. They jumped around, they didn't go way outside of their genre, but they definitely jumped around different angles of I'm going to keep saying pop punk because it's super catchy choruses, and that was kind of the heyday of the pop punk, I guess. We've come to love.
For better, for worse.
Right.
When I got into punk music around 1996, Unwritten Law was always a band that just kept popping up, you know. But I never really focused on them. I don't know why. You know, they just kind of, they were always there. I knew who they were. You know, I'd heard a few tunes from the Oz Factor, which, you know, come out in 96, but nothing really caught me. You know, I didn't really latch on to anything. And it
Yeah,
wasn't until I met you that I really got into these guys.
I opened the
You
door
were the one,
to a
Wayne,
punk rock band
because,
for you.
yeah, Unwritten Law,
Wow.
Black Album was like the one punk CD that you had in this giant CD case, like one of those, like those flippable binder, you know, CD
Yeah.
books.
Like, everybody has illegible names. I have no idea what any of this is.
Yeah, and I always thought
I can't
that
even
that
read any of these.
Was so funny. So I actually remember this as clear as day, like flipping through that, looking for something to listen to. And I saw Unwritten Law in there, and I was like, okay, punk CD. So I threw it in. I was really pleasantly surprised by it. I mean, I thought it was really, from first listen, I thought it was really great. The production was great compared to Oz Factor. Not that Oz Factor was poorly produced, but like you were just saying, you know, the record was dynamic. It was a little bit more interesting to listen to. There was cool stuff going on. I mean, I don't know how many punk records in 98 had like phasers on the guitars and like had all this like kind of neat stuff. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. You know, like I wouldn't have thought to have done that. It just sounded like they were really working hard to craft solid music.
Right. Yeah. It was like a lot of intricate variations, like from song to song on that whole album. And again, it was literally just this one album for me, an Unwritten Law. Like, that's it. Like, I didn't really know of them before this Black album came out. And honestly, I haven't really kept track of them since that album came out. I think they had a good run after that Black album where they were putting out albums like every year or every other year for at least the next album or two. But like, you know, I just totally lost track of them. But for some reason, this album in particular, like, really stood out to me. I guess it just really caught my eye and held my attention, I guess.
Caught your ear.
Held my ear for all that, all the diverse songs and stuff.
Well, Wayne, this was the compromise record. Whenever we went on long car trips to some of the shows we played, this was like, you know, the punk record. So it was like the punk record that you liked and the punk record that I liked. So we just would always listen to this once you were in your car.
Yep.
You know, eventually we got into some more stuff that we had in more, you know, more commonality. But at first, this was the one record that, okay, we'll throw this on because it's the one that we both like.
All right. Nice. But good to have that commonality.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, though, is it doesn't stop there, because when Unwritten Law's Elva came out, remember, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the best decisions that you and I ever made in college was we took that job at Subway. On campus. And speaking of just letting you do whatever the hell you want, we used to throw that record Elva on all the time in that back room when we were throwing shit into the fry later and
putting new toppings on pizza.
Exploring with what could go on a pizza. We listened to a ton of Elva too. So it's kind of like, you know, we have this band in common. When I think of Unwritten Law, man, I think about you and I think about all those times. So
All right. You know, Elva, I remember listening to it a whole bunch. And I think, you know, it was just like, oh, new Unwritten Law songs. Like, oh, okay, cool. And I never bought that album or anything. I just remember listening to it a lot. Like, I don't know why it didn't stick. I don't know why it didn't stick for me like the Black album did. I think I liked it. I don't ever remember being like, oh, this again. You know, I think I liked it. But again, I don't know what it was. Something about that Black album was really just like, it was like the right amount of catchy and the right amount of like intricate studio work to like, you know, keep me interested in listening over and over again, because like there was enough stuff so you could kind of even discover, like, you know, be like, oh wow, they really did switch that, all the guitar tones, and just like the, you know, there's six different effects per song, and like, huh, they really put that together. It took them a while to like, I'm assuming it took them a while to you know, think of all that stuff through. I'm thinking they must have had like a vision for that. All right, we kind of want, you know, this sound for these parts and like this sound for that part and this and this and this. But it all ties together well. I mean, I guess that's where the production really comes in, is to like, you know, put together these ridiculous ideas that some, you know, crazy band member is like, yeah, I want to sound like these 12 other songs all at the same time. And like, but, they did it really well.
Yeah.
Again, that really kept me listening. And do you think the next album after the Black album had that same draw? Did they do that same amount of diversity in the songwriting or in the studio?
Well, I do. I really like Elva. You know, I could do without all the goofy shit, like the random guy talking and some of the stuff in there, but if you kind of like, remember when you could like load your CD onto iTunes and cut all that crap out? So, you know, I would set up like a good version of Elva where I would cut out all that Ronnie Shaker stuff that they got from Sublime. Yeah, the songs are great. They're there. So Yeah, I don't know. Give it another listen.
And maybe I will. Yeah, yeah. Because yeah. I mean, again, it was literally just that era. I think when we were
was it the lasers, you know, Wayne? Were you turned off by the lasers in that one song?
I might have been.
All right. Well, let's plunge into these self-titled songs. The record starts off with harmonic. After tuning up, the song starts off on that D power chord, you know, with the phaser, you know, the harmonics come in with the title, where the title comes from. And I love that intro. It's definitely one of my favorite pop punk late 90s, like CD opener intros out there.
Oh, yeah. All right. The tune up, and then.
I just love that. I wish I had thought of that, you know, like. Like, who starts a record with tuning? It's like when the Beatles started Revolver with, you know, George Harrison coughing into the mic, or John, or whoever. You know, it's kind of like unconventional, but it really kind of gives the record, the song, some character, you know? Scott sings, facing different ways, different planes, and I don't want to drag it out. And I just got to get on out and leave it all behind. It's time, so don't deny it. You know, it's a song I feel where, you know, he doesn't want to dwell on stuff. What we had shared had run empty, so let it be. You know, he's just kind of like, you know, I don't want to dwell on this. I'm going to move on, you know?
I liked it. I thought harmonic was a good way to open the album, for sure. Yeah, and they're just starting right in with being catchy and having hooks, and yeah.
It's definitely one of the best choruses on the record, you know. It's just driving forward, and it's extremely melodic.
Yeah, I would think so. It was a super solid way to start the album. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it definitely got me interested in the whole rest of the album. I mean, even in hearing it, like, you know, right when you talked to me about, like, oh, maybe we'll do this this Unwritten Law album, I was like, okay, well, it's been a minute since I listened to it, so let me go back and check it out. And like, after he tuned up and like the song just started, I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I remember this. Like, and that was it. It was like, I remember the whole album from like that, the first couple of chords. I was like, yeah, I remember.
Cleared
out
the claptrap in your brain, and you're like, oh yeah.
Why did I lose it? I lost it in the ocean of music.
Right off the bat, it shows Scott's vocal range. You know, he could really kind of go for those high notes where if you listen to him live, he doesn't always hit them, but you know, with a little studio help or a little, you know, opportunity to hit it again. You know, he can really, really get up there with the best of them. But his voice, yeah. I always liked his voice because I felt like it wasn't grating. His voice was kind of like...
It's a little punk rockish. He's got a little scratch in there, yeah. For sure. He's got a little aggressive scratchiness. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think when you get as many takes as you want, it helps. Sure. But also, you're really just focused on it, I think, in the studio, too. Like,
yeah.
You know, not to say that I've never seen them live, but, you know, I know when you're live, it's like you got, you know, a million things going on. So, you know, you don't get to, like, literally just focus on this one line of lyrics at a time.
And you've been drinking. And
right. Exactly.
Really good song. I was surprised when they put out the hit list, their greatest hits record, that they re-recorded a lot of these early tunes. And I don't know. I feel like the re-recorded version pales in comparison to the Black Album version. And that might be because I've heard the Black Album version a bazillion times. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just being like picky, but it just, to me, it doesn't have the same energy. It doesn't have like the same like youthful fire that self-titled one has. It just kind of sounds like they're, I don't want to say like not into it, because they're clearly into it. They're in the studio, they're paying money, like, you know, like when people say they don't sound like they're into it, they definitely sound into it, but it lacks like that immediacy, you know.
I'll have to give that a listen. I know they re-recorded a bunch of these songs, but I don't think I've actually heard that version. I may have, but I definitely don't remember it for comparative sake. You know, it's almost like for the sake of re-recording it, you know, to be re-recording it. And this version, they definitely had a vision of knowing what they wanted to do with it, like right off of the bat, and had a lot of freshness and energy about how they wanted to do it. Whereas like we're thinking about a new way to do it when we already kind of got it how we wanted it in the first place. So
yeah. Well, it is interesting to note that it was probably all new players in the band. I mean, I know at least the drummer was different. So maybe giving some of the new guys a shot at it. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't sound that great. And, you know, I've seen videos, you know, where they're down to a single guitarist and Scott is playing guitar on these songs and he's doing the harmonics and stuff. So, you know, it's tough when it's not the same guys, you know, playing it all the time.
True. Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's move on to the next song, Teenage Suicide. So I love harmonic. I love Teenage Suicide. You know, it's like you have that great opening tune and then it hits right into this song. It comes sailing in after harmonic and just even kicks the tempo up just a little bit. Like,
yeah,
good, you know, sequencing there. You get a strong opener, but then your second track is like even better. So it's like,
oh yeah, it almost like set the pace for the whole album.
Yeah,
you're like, oh well, all of these songs are gonna be good then.
So yeah, you're literally like, that song was awesome, whoa, this song is better, you know. It's like
oh, so you like Teenage Suicide better than harmonic?
Well, I don't know if I do, but the way it comes out of it and the way it's like a little faster, sometimes I fool myself into being like, oh wow, yeah, this song.
Just the tempo wise,
yeah, they tricked
me. Oh yes,
yeah,
yes,
they trick me.
They trick you. No, but they're both good songs. For me, they're pretty equal, which is really good to have at the beginning of the album. Like, it just, again, it holds your attention. And I mean, that's the majority of this album for me, is like, it just keeps going. Yeah, it's a great song. I mean, same thing. I mean, like every song on this album, I almost have the same, almost every song, I have the same type of, you know, reaction to it. It's like super catchy, you know, choruses and lots to pay attention to, and like, you know, it's got a lot of interest. I mean, I like it.
Yeah, I could just record you saying that and then like copy and paste it throughout the
right. I'm done, you got what you need.
All right, right? Thanks a lot. No, yeah, you know, I'm a sucker for some good palm muting, and I love the palm mutes in the verses. And while that's happening, the other guitar is just like making these like kind of like squawking out these cool kind of like guitar lines that like don't really, they add like ambiance, you know, they're like really cool.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine them starting with that. Be like, hey guys, let's check out this song that I got.
Yeah.
I think that's studio magic. I think they were like, yeah, let's add some more stuff on here. Think of some more guitar to fill it in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's studio magic. I mean, I guess you could fool around with that stuff in band rehearsal and whatnot and come up with it there. But, and I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. That's the totally fine way to write songs and add stuff to them. But I feel like it had that feel to it.
Yeah. Like we got to put something in there, and who knows, you know, they actually have there's a series of clips on YouTube of them playing live in 97. I don't know if it's around the time, it must've been around the time they were recording this record. It'd be interesting to see if, or hear if those parts are in there.
Be interesting to see if they were kind of feeling out some of those random, I mean, seemingly random. I mean, they flow together great. I think the songs wouldn't be the way they are without them.
Yeah. And I think you're right about just like the studio being a great place to really kind of play with this music and work with it, because it's, the whole record is very dynamic and it's got lots of layered guitars and lead lines throughout. And I really feel like Rick Parashar really helped this band kind of kick through that, like that, you know, that general like plodding forward sound of, you know, Oz Factor, which again is a record I like, but when you compare it to this record, I mean, that record was produced by Greg Graffin of Bad Religion, who, you know, he's Greg Graffin, so automatically he's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's not a professional producer. He's not a Rick Parashar, you know? So it's like you can really kind of tell that when you bring in a guy, like, this is his, he's in his wheelhouse when he's producing. Like, it really shows. I mean, no disrespect to Graffin, but he's not on level with someone like Parashar, you know? And Parashar also mixed this record, which I don't know how often the producer will mix. I don't know. You know, on that side of things, I'm ignorant, but you know, being in the room with the guys producing it and then mixing it, I feel like he just really had a finger on the pulse of what they were all trying to do.
Yeah, I guess so. I didn't know he was mixing it as well as, you know, well, I know he produced it, but I mean, I didn't know he was mixing it as well. He's all over that thing. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know where they got it mastered, but I mean, but even so, I'm sure he had a pile of notes to send along, you know, if they did send it out to get mastered and stuff too.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Oh yeah. In this one, Scott sings, "The walls are closing in on me. I cannot see. Appearing fine. Well, that's all a lie because I'm not all right." The song seems to be about teens who struggle but don't have anyone in their corner encouraging them to open up. You know, oh, you're fine. Being brushed off by adults, you know, but teenage depression is a massively serious thing that people just don't really seem to understand. You know, you get a lot of that, you know, you'll grow out of it, and, you know, being a teen is tough, and, or even like the dismissive, you're being dramatic, you know.
right. Or you'll get over it. Yeah. You know? It's just teen stuff, you know.
And this song, I think, does a really good job of saying, you know, hey, no, I'm not all right. You know, I'm not going to get over it. There's a video for this song. They shot a video, and someone in the comments section said the kid in the video is now in the band. And I know YouTube comments are laughably distrustful, but man, I so want that to be true. Like, that kid in the video is now, like, I don't know, playing guitar or bass or whatever. I don't know. I couldn't verify it. I have no idea, but
I want it to be true.
I want that to be true. Another song re-recorded for Hit List. It plays about the same. Bonus points for having Tony from Poli on drums on it, but you know, they didn't really diverge too far from the original on this one.
Yeah, do you think this is one of like the top songs on the album? I mean, like that they pushed the most in having a video. I felt like this may have been their original like attempt at having a single, like, or you know,
yeah,
it's gonna be one of our big tracks.
All right, let's get into the next track, Sorry. This one is pretty straightforward. The subject is lusting after a girl, but at first the girl isn't having it, you know? She tells him to slow down because she's not easy. Then he tries again. Yep. Same thing happens again. But then there's a third section. And now all of a sudden she's ready and really into it. So I don't know. The moral of the story, I guess, is
just wear the ladies down. That's the moral. Just wear them down.
Be patient and your partner will come running, I guess. Yeah, or wear them down, or just
wear them down.
Or it's the late 90s and this is like macho bro music.
Right. Like now we kind of look at it and it was a little bit like, oh, they could totally sing this song kind of like ironically, you know.
I don't think they sing this one ironically. I don't know though.
If that's how I don't think that was the intention when it came out.
No.
But yeah, it's a little cringy now looking back at it.
Yeah.
Still catchy song, but still it's a little like, huh.
Well, I'm going to pair this one with another cringy song later on in the album. And, you know, I really love Unwritten Law. I really love their music. You know, I have a hard time reading about all the fights that they get into amongst each other and some of the weird stuff that I hear coming out. I mean, you know, I have to take all that with a grain of salt because I'm not there. I don't know these people. But, you know, you read some stuff and you're kind of like, oh, that's not cool.
Inner band turmoil. They've had a lot of that. I mean, I mean, obviously just looking at the lineup changes and stuff, you know, there's some turnover going on there. I mean, I guess that happens if you're a band for 30 years or so.
Yeah. The song, I just kind of like I love that riff. Like, I think that riff is really cool. The, you know, one of those riffs you hear and you automatically can just picture it, how it goes on the guitar and instantly know how to play it. But it's like, it's so effective here.
You know, you're talking about the one that starts, the song starts with?
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
And it's a really cool part. Like, I like that a lot. It's simple, but it's cool. It's just, it's too bad that they couldn't have paired it with something maybe a little bit more interesting lyrically. But I always thought it was cool. And it's a bit of a departure from, like, you know, the straightforward punk rock that the band had been doing. This is kind of like a different tone, really.
It's like, right. It's like a little bit more straightforward rock. And I think they go in and out of that every once in a while. Like, it's not all that fast, you know, punk rockish 90s stuff of that era. And I think that's why I kind of liked it more than a lot of that other stuff, you know, the NOFX or, you know, that type of California punk that was, you know, it was all kind of like, I think you guys are using a lot of cut and paste for drum work there. So I think that's probably why I liked it a little bit. Nothing's wrong with that drum, you know, the drum work on a NOFX album is fine too. But you know, I think it's good to have the variety.
Yeah.
And come back to it too, to have some of those parts that will anchor it, you know, but also, you know, branch out too. My attention span needs different songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Different textures.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about this record is some of the people that they brought in. So in this song, this track alone was mixed by Andy Wallace, who's a pretty well-known name. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like, if Interscope was just trying different stuff, trying to get different mixes, trying to, like, beef up singles or lining up potential singles. Maybe someone heard this one and it was like, oh, that could maybe be a single. I'm very fascinated by the personnel on this record.
Yeah. Like, they really... Well, maybe it was just to bring in some more names and like, oh, all these people had their hand in it. So, you know.
Sure. Name record.
It's going to be awesome. Everybody should buy it.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. The next song on the record is California Sky. Well, here's your message from above. And if you want to make plans, come to shovel ride. This ain't no lullaby. Is this song really about aliens?
Message is it really from about above?
I mean, I originally, like, back in the day, thought it was like a religious thing, but, you know, the more I read that these guys like to hang out with Blink-182 and everything, I'm like, oh, this is probably a song about aliens, you know?
Yeah, I think I got some of that. I just kind of chalked it all up to just kind of ridiculous silliness. I didn't really think it was like I didn't look for a lot of deep meaning. You know, in most of the songs, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
I just like them for the catchiness and, you know, everything else they were putting into it, you know, musically. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, I don't really look too deeply into the lyrically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, definitely not at that genre and at that time.
Yeah, well, like a lot of songs, I mean, it's not specific enough for you to be like, oh, it's a linear narrative about, like, you know, his day at work or something. But there are, you know, there are fun things in there to catch, you know, references to space and the sky and,
oh yeah,
and stuff like that. So I was kind of like, oh, I think this might be something different than I originally thought it was, you know. So it's kind of fun. You know, it's like when you hear a song and then you read an interview with the songwriter and they're explaining how it's about something and you're like, oh, I thought it was about something completely different.
Yeah.
But that's like kind of the fun thing about like song lyrics sometimes is they can be whatever the hell you want them to be. I mean, if whatever it means to you when you hear it, you know, certain lines will resonate with you or images. And
yeah,
I'm always really into that. I like songs that like will purposely be a little ambiguous so that my imagination can kind of run with it a bit.
Yeah. It doesn't need to be so straightforward to, like, you know, you don't have to read between any of these lines. This is obviously, we're going to make it as straightforward as possible to say exactly what I'm saying. Like, yeah, I mean, that's too one-dimensional. It's fine to be straightforward and have a catchy chorus that everybody can identify with. But I mean, trying to do that without being totally cliche is pretty hard these days. And I don't think these, you know, the lyrics from California Sky were, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't think they were nonsensical. I think they were painting a picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
but again, not that the picture's a poignant representation of, you know, modern life and its troubles and woes. And, you know, I don't think it was a deep. It wasn't very deep.
No.
I didn't need it to be.
No.
It was just a good song.
It's a good song.
That's all I wanted. That's all I needed.
Well, it took me all the way until maybe last week to finally get around to watching the video, which has plenty of images of aliens and spacecrafts.
Ah.
Yeah, you know, that kind of was like, oh, okay. But yeah, just, you know, another a good song on it. It's just another, you know, good tempo throughout the song, interesting parts. Another good one.
It's another solid one.
Yeah.
It's another solid one. Mm-hmm. It was good all the way through. There wasn't any weird parts, you know, that I was like, all right, guys, come on.
Yeah.
Move it along. Get it back to the rocking or, you know, anything like that. That's four good ones right in a row.
Got to keep it going.
Yeah.
The next song on the record is Kaylin. No one ever made me feel the way that you do. And hey, little girl, look what you do. Oh, I love you. This song comes with a bit of an interesting backstory. So according to Scott Russo, it's about my 4-year-old baby girl. I wrote that song acoustically just for her. I didn't expect Unwritten Law to play it, let alone put it on the record. The song is about how much her daddy loves her. This is what he told In Music We Trust, interview website. Another podcast I listen to, Podio Slave, he also talks about how he just kind of had this song. He had worked it out, like, you know, maybe in his hotel room. It was just for him, just for his daughter. It was not going to be an Unwritten Law song. According to Scott in Scene Zine, we were recording the record, and our A&R guy was like, all right, what else you got? What other songs do you have? I guess they were kind of still looking for that single, right? According to Scott, I showed him the song I wrote for my daughter. We were a punk rock band, and I wrote the song that was strictly a gift for my baby, for her mommy, and for us. When I played the song for our publicist, he was like, that song's a fucking hit. It's going on the record. I was like, no, bro, it can't. It's pop. It's not Unwritten Law. And he said, no, it's going on the record. And I've got to be honest with you, if I had not have had that girl, I wouldn't have written that song. If I didn't have the girl and hadn't have written that song, my career would have ended. That was my first top 20 single here in the USA, and we were about to get dropped just previous to this. So me having her and writing the song for her and about her and making it the record and becoming a single and then single-handedly saved and made our career. So, I mean, that's kind of a crazy story.
Yeah, songs come from everywhere, I suppose.
Well, it doesn't end there, Wayne, so get this.
Oh, boy.
It almost wasn't a single at all. Then-guitarist Rob Brewer told MTV.com that the three previous singles from Unwritten Law, the band's third album, failed to take off. And when Interscope began dropping artists after its parent company, Universal, merged with PolyGram in December, the band became worried. We were kind of expecting the worst, Brewer said. They said, we're going to keep you guys, but we're not going to really work the album anymore. We want you to go back and do another one. And that was kind of a bummer, because we had always thought that Kaylin would be a good radio single. The band pushed it themselves, sending it out to K-Rock. Being so influential at the time, getting airtime there meant getting airtime in other places. Band manager Bill Sylvia explained to MTV.com, we kept hearing from K-Rock that almost right out of the box, it was just a great, impactful song with listeners. Yeah, I mean, to me, like, they had it in the studio. The A&R guy thought it was a hit. Interscope doesn't release it as a single for three singles. Then they're like, well, you can push it. You know, the song, to me, screams single. You know, someone really goofed running this song out first, you know?
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, it definitely stands out for me personally. I wasn't one of my favorite songs on the album. Mm. I did like it. I definitely liked it for what it was. I don't think I could get past the mid-90s turntables.
Record scratches.
I could not. I couldn't do it. And even at the time, I knew I felt like it was so cheesy. Yeah. I was like, ugh.
That's an eye roll. Yeah. DJ right, Jeff yeah, Turner. Yeah. On turntables. Yeah.
Like, ooh, that's so...
I was never a fan when bands would roll out the turntable scratch in the middle of a song.
I was like, that is so revealing of the era this came from. I was like,
painful. Yeah. Remember in Batman Returns when Michael Keaton is playing the recording and he does the record scratch? What is it with the record scratch in the late 90s? Like,
I don't know.
Did people just like have this like weird obsession with record scratches? Like, let's put one in.
Yeah. We need more of that. No, you don't. You don't need more of that. But yeah, it's totally indicative of the era. This album has that kind of stuff throughout it.
Right. Some of it's going to be hit. Some of it's going to be miss.
Right. And overall, this song worked great. I mean, like, I definitely see why it was a single. Eventually, I guess. Mm. I didn't know that there were so many passes on it. Yeah, when it was reluctantly a single. kind of on both sides, really. Like, apparently at different times, no one wanted it to be a single. You know, like, oh, well, the record, you know, the initial record company didn't like it enough as a single. And then the band, or I don't know if it was the band, but it was, you know, the main guy there, the singer, didn't like it on the album at all, I guess. And then it was the ultimatum of like, it's that or you're out. You got to put it on the album or you're out.
Yeah, the genesis of the song is like, very interesting.
Turn of events, to say, yeah.
Well, according to Scott, the rest of the band was like, why the hell didn't you show us this song earlier? Like, they were into it. Everybody was into it. And yeah, it's definitely poppy. It's a poppy song.
Yeah.
The record scratches are definitely an eye roll, but it doesn't make or break the tune for me. It's definitely not one of my favorite songs on the record, but I can definitely appreciate it for just a, you know, piece of wonderful pop music. I mean, I think that it's definitely a hit. It's a single. Like, I don't know why they didn't run this one out first.
I mean, it does. Again, the way that they put it together, at least, I don't know if this was like the first or 12th version of it, but it definitely has a different sound than the rest of the album. Like, it feels like it was definitely set up as a single. I mean, like, it is a very good, solid song. Mm-hmm. Like, I can definitely see why it's a single on this album, for sure.
That's a good one. All right, let's move on to Lonesome. Association with the past, so think about it. It's like a dad that's in a bus. Don't move so
fast. Don't run, because you might find out. It's my favorite song on the album.
I love this song.
I don't mean to mix words.
This is one of my favorites too, man. I love this one.
Yeah, it's just got that rockin'. Yeah, it's just that headbanging rockin' riff. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, it slides right out of it, right back into the, you know, pop punk, you know, quick little palm mutes.
It's a head bopper.
Yeah, that is the hook. That got me. The first jamming riff. And it's the same thing. It's got awesome chorus, you know, it's super catchy. The whole song all the way through is like memorable for me. Yeah. Like the little buildups and stuff that are throughout there. I think even on the last chorus, there was like it's not a long buildup, but it's like, oh, it just slams right back into it. It's like, it's got all the things I was looking for.
Yeah. And he had just great melodies. I mean, he must've just had these humming them in his car or whatever, but they're like, and I still feel lonesome. I mean, that's just brilliant. It's great.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like the cadence of the lyrics with that riff. Oh man, it's just again, it's my favorite song on the album.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. This is one of those good guy wishes girl would notice or be with him songs. You know, he knows that it's probably not the best situation. Even compares it at one point to a catastrophe. So. But, you know, in the end, when she does come around, he realizes she was never there for him. You know, maybe she's just using him. So it's one of those things where, like, you want the person. And then when they're ready, or they decide, like, okay, fine, I'll settle with you. Then you're like, oh, but you were never there for me. You never really liked me. So now I don't like you anymore. It's kind of like, I don't know, maybe the chase is more interesting or something. I don't know.
I always thought it was just kind of like, yeah, it wasn't as good as you thought it was going to be.
Hmm.
It always was what it was until you got into it. And then you're like, yeah, this sucks.
Yeah.
This isn't anything that I wanted.
You wanted something, but you didn't want that. Like, you know?
Yes.
You're filling a void with something. There's some desirable component But then when you have it, you're like, oh, but wait a minute.
Right.
This is not filling that
this
void.
Is not what I thought it was.
I love the bass on this song. I think the bass really kind of shines on this one.
Yep.
Another interesting note on this song, Wayne, is according to Scott and Scene Zine, this song was a single in Australia, and they needed a video for it immediately. So according to Scott, we didn't have a budget for it. So I'm like, fuck, how do we make a video for it? At the time, a Tom Petty video had come out, and it was this long, solid shot. How can we do that with no money? I drafted the whole treatment for that video. My friend was going to university in the film department, and I was like, can you get a camera? I told him it was going to be us walking down the street in San Diego while I was singing the words, and Wade, the drummer, is going to be beating everybody up. That's the video. Just one shot. I fucking love it. That's according to Scott. And I love that video. I remember watching that one back in the day and just thinking it was the funniest thing. It's just him walking down the street singing, but every once in a while, someone will walk past the band and Wade will just go off on him and like beat the person up or steal their pocketbook or knock them off their bike. I always thought that was brilliant. I love videos like that where it's just like some dumb, subtle thing that like makes you laugh as you're watching it, you know?
I'll have to look for that. Dude, I didn't even know they had a video for this.
Yeah, check it out. It's funny.
I'll definitely have to check that out. But going back to what you just quickly mentioned about, like, you know, this was a big song in Australia. I guess they were mega, mega huge in Australia.
Yeah.
So maybe it was just in the States, I guess. They never really caught on, but, mm-hmm. you know, maybe caught a lot of fame in Australia, I guess.
Yeah. The next song in the record, Coffin Text. One of the faster songs on here, I like it, but the lyrics always kind of puzzled me. There was a time when men would prosper. They saw a sign that would offer them the key, immortality. The desert sand held a place of recourse, their motivation driven by a higher source. And then the song goes on to reference like buried desert tombs, pharaohs. It's kind of like, it's almost like Scott saw a documentary on Egypt or something, was like, oh yeah. Like, you know, he's like looking for ideas, looking for things to write about. I mean, I like it. It's cool, but it's like, I want to know, like, I want to ask him if I ever got a chance to interview him. Like, where did you get the motivation for Coffin Text?
When did that Bryn Fraser movie, The Mummy, come out?
about? Maybe saw that one.
There's no pad with him in the theater.
It even has the lead guitar line that's like kind of playing these like minor notes, like, you know, kind of like has this mysterious quality to it, especially in the middle. You know how that middle section where it like really slows down? There's actually some more harmonics in there. And then it ramps up again. But, you know, it has like this kind of like mystical thing to it.
Egyptian-ish kind of themed. Yeah, I know what
you're talking about. They create that mood. Like, I don't know what Egyptian music sounds like, but like
you know, stereotypical Egyptian music, not like actual
movie Egyptian music. Yeah,
right movie grade.
But then there's like that cool, like that effect that they put on the backing vocals, you know, like that fade in effect that they do. So like they're really kind of like laying on the ideas. I can just imagine these guys in the studio like, okay, what can we do to this one to give it like this
give it a feel,
this tone. Yeah,
right, all the parts have the same feel but in a different way. Studio magic.
Yeah,
that's studio magic right there, in a good way.
Coffin texts are a collection of ancient Egyptian funerary spells written on coffins, usually to help the spirit of a concerned person to be preserved in the afterlife. So I did not know what coffin texts were before I kind of delved into this one.
I didn't know it was even a thing you could delve into. Just like, it's writing on a coffin, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you can only sing so many songs about skateboarding and
Georgia the Jungle. Yeah.
Are you still on this Brendan Fraser thing?
Yep. I'm glad you caught on to that.
Oh, man. All right. Let's move on to Holiday. To me, this is a song about just appreciating life, you know, not getting too bogged down with work or authorities or, you know, whatever's on the teenage mind. I don't know how old these guys were when this record came out, but he quite simply states, life's a holiday. And yeah, I guess it is if you treat it as such. I mean,
right. Get some hand claps. Get a whole bunch of singing. It's really upbeat.
This one kind of caught me off guard a little bit. You know, coming out of Coffin Text with all those minor notes and like,
right?
Then all of a sudden you've got this one. It's like, oh, we're doing like a 180 here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It totally feels that way. I mean, again, a good song. It was like, I got cavities listening to this thing.
Yeah.
So like sugary sweet. I'm like, is it a little bit ironic? I mean, like, you know, it's a good message.
Yeah.
But like, right. We were just coming off of Coffin Text and Lonesome.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, are we being ironic? Is it like,
I kind of feel like I was set up.
I kind of thought it wasn't. And even like the way that they end the song, like in mid lyrics,
yeah,
to get into the next song,
right,
made me kind of think like, it's a little bit ironic, you know, that they're like, it's a holiday. They're like singing and clapping where, and they don't do that anywhere else on the album,
no.
At least to that level of super sugary popness. Again, good song, good message.
Yeah,
I feel like there's a,
I mean, I rank on this stuff out of complete love for this record, but to me this one was always kind of like, I was always kind of like, this is a little, like you said, yeah, I got cavities,
a little much,
listen, that's just a little right. Over the top, and maybe they, yeah, I don't know, but again, like knowing kind of like where the band was at this point, like, you know, on this major and experimenting with new ideas and trying stuff out, bringing different producers and people to mix. Like, I think like at this point, like this might've been like an identity time for the band. Like, what, you know, what do we want to do? You know, we're going to try out some different stuff here and kind of see what works, you know, got the poppiness of Kaylin. You got the really fast, straightforward two songs that open the record. You've got songs like Lonesome and Sorry with the big guitar riffs, you know. Later you've got Underground, which has kind of like a bouncy kind of tone to it. So, you know,
bouncy,
we call the record like, diverse, but it's creepy. Also kind of like, hey, let's try some different stuff and see what we like, you know.
But I think that was their sound.
Yeah.
To be diverse. That's your sound.
Yeah, because they continue. I mean, they've been diverse ever since. I mean, we talked a little bit about Elva at the start of this podcast, and that record's very diverse. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff on there. Acoustic songs.
Yeah.
There's even like a what I guess would classify as a ska song. There's all kinds of stuff on there, you know?
Nice.
Maybe even a rap song. I don't know. A cool fun fact about Holiday is that Buck 09 saxophone player Craig Yarnold offers additional backing vocals and hand claps on this song. He actually told me that he was roommates with Scott at the time, and one night just headed over to the studio with him and just was hanging out, did some vocals, put some hand claps on there, and... It's cool. Like Buck 09 and Unwritten Love always kind of had like this cool connection, you know, being from the same area. Buck 09 played horns on Unwritten Love's cover of Goody Two Shoes for the Before You Were Punk tribute to the 80s comp from back in the day. And I know they've played a lot of shows together and stuff like that. And so it's kind of cool. A little connection there.
Yeah, it's fun.
The late Johnny Mathias engineered this one. Seems like, again, like the label was bringing in different folks to try to catch something.
Mm.
And interestingly, this song has a video, kind of a strange video where they're hanging out in a classroom and there's like, I don't know, like a sub that's asleep at a desk. It was a single, it was released, but this song was left off of the hit list. So... A hit, had a video, the only song left off of hit list. So something tells me maybe the band, even agrees that this one was a little over the top. I don't know. It's an interesting thing, though, that I noticed.
Yeah, that's true. I would agree with them.
Yeah.
I think you got it. You got it the first time. You don't need to, you don't need to redo that one. Yeah. You got it. That's fine.
The next song on the record is Underground. Let me help you through the suffering. I know you hurt again. So trust in me now. Stop. Breathe. Look inside of me. And tell me what do you see. This is a cool bouncy tune with some sort of like neat effect on the bass. Do you know what that is? I don't know what that is. It has like a bubbly sound.
How would you describe it?
Like a bubbly kind of sound? Or
bubbly?
Like, yeah. Hmm. I don't really know how to describe that sound. Like some gear nerd out there probably knows exactly what that.
Yeah. It's the bass is different. Definitely different on that song. I mean, maybe it's more pronounced than most of the other songs. Do you know if anybody was guest mixing this one or, you know, they call in someone different for this? That bass seems more pronounced than any of the other songs.
Yes, mixed by Kelly Gray, who would later join Queensryche in 1998. So how about that?
And he must like the bass.
No idea if he likes the wobbly gonka gonka bass, but...
donka donka bass.
But, you know, I got to be honest, though. I feel like they had to do something. It's a cool bass line, but it's one of the easiest bass lines ever. I mean, it's literally three notes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had to spice it up a little bit, I guess. You know,
someone was like, we got to do something just, with that. Yeah.
Right, right. Or just the kind of a how you're hitting them, how you're hitting those notes, mm-hmm. You know, matters. I mean, again, they brought it up. You know, it's definitely front and center. Mm-hmm. Like that bass line's right there.
In this song, he's basically asking someone to trust him, follow him to the underground. He promises to take care of someone and ease their pain. He sings, "Let me help you through the suffering. I know you're hurt again, so trust in me now." The extension of the hand of helpfulness, I don't know. This is kind of like an uplifter.
I guess so if you're reading the lyrics, but I thought that the tonality of the song was kind of, I don't know. Feels a little creepy.
Mm. It you feels know. Like wobbly and unstable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe that's a better way to describe it. Yeah. Just kind of like, I don't trust him. I'm not going in that underground.
I'm not going down there.
That's the feeling I got.
It stinks down there.
It's like, I know you're asking me to go somewhere. I'm not going. I don't know where you're taking me. But if that's the baseline you're playing, I'm out.
And interestingly, this song is, you know, for me, not, I mean, it's a good song, not one of the highlights of the record for me at all, but this is the song that they opened with on 2008's live album that they put out, Live and Lawless. I thought that was a really interesting choice to open with this song. This does not scream opener to me.
Again, it's got some cool riffs in it. I definitely like the, you know, when it the guitar comes in to match the bass and stuff, starts slamming. The song starts slamming, but an opener to get everybody really riled up, and yeah, I don't see that happening.
No.
Again, it's a good song.
It's bouncy. It's the kind of song you want to play later in the set when people are a little loosened up and they're ready to start, you know, bouncing up and down.
Mm-hmm.
As a show opener, I don't know. I mean, what do I know? But
yep.
All right, Wayne, I want to move on to Close Your Eyes. Won't you close your eyes? This song kicks right in, and it's a song about, in my opinion, like the poor choices that people make, you know, that sort of set them on a path either to violence or, you know, even death, whether it's extremism or gang violence.
Mm-hmm.
The first verse speaks of a young kid who shaves his head and professes nationalism. The second, a kid who gets involved in gangs and messes with
the people. Oh, yeah, this is definitely like the Bob Dylan painting a picture of... Mm-hmm. The Americana. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like a, it's very like storyteller punk rock.
Yeah. Once there was a boy who, yeah. very straightforward. You know, there's, like we were talking earlier about straightforward lyrics versus ambiguous mm-hmm. ones. This one's a little more straightforward.
Yep.
At the, about the halfway point, it sort of switches up tempo-wise, and this is the point where Scott is basically like, hey, can't we all just get along? Can't we all just hang out and drink some beers? But I don't know. But the thing that always caught me was there's like whistling. They got someone to like do some whistle along with that part, which I was like, all right, here we go.
Professional whistler.
Trying another thing, you know? I mean, my hat's off to them for like trying some different stuff. And like we said earlier, you know, some stuff works and some stuff, you know, I don't know, take it or leave it. I mean, none of this stuff for me ruins the record. None of it taints the songs. But I'm always like, that's an interesting choice. Like,
yeah. Huh, whistling.
Let's throw a whistle in there.
They had a band meeting. They're like, you know, we need more whistling in this bridge.
Do we got a guy who can whistle?
Everybody, let's vote.
Rob, can you whistle? What about you? Wade, whistle? No? Right. Yeah?
Whistle. We got to bring someone in. We got to bring in a professional whistler. Get him in here. Who do we know? Get the Rolodex out.
There's no credit. It's not like, you know.
Yeah, there's no, right. There's no asterisk next to the song. Guest whistler.
Yeah.
From.
And it's someone like really like amazing. Like.
This is definitely we had Bon Jovi come in and whistle.
Yeah.
On the bridge on this one. Like what? Interesting. Yeah. I'd rather see these, you know, interesting little changes and trying out stuff than not, though.
Like,
take a shot rather than, you know, just the same generic stuff, you know.
Well, that's just it. Yeah, if you never take chances on those like weird little things, you're never going to get some of the brilliant stuff. Because for everything that doesn't work out too well, think about all the amazing things you've heard on records where you're like, oh my god, like I don't know, how did they think of that? Like, that's such a cool thing, you know.
I'm sure many times, you know, even the band was probably like, I don't know.
We'll see how this goes.
Right.
If we can get it past the producer and then past the label, I think we're going to be all right.
Yeah.
Definitely one of the cooler guitar solos on the record, though. I don't know who takes this one, Steve Morris or Rob Brewer, but I like this guitar solo on this song.
So yeah, it's like a legit solo. Yeah.
Which you don't hear too many of on this record. For two really good guitar players, there aren't a ton of solos. There's a lot of lead lines, not so many solos.
Yeah, the ambient, like you know, adding more layers or octaves to, you know, the guitar work on the album is kind of, you know, throughout the whole thing. But yeah, to like literally have a designated solo area in one of your songs, they did not do that a lot.
Mm-hmm. The next song on the record is Before I Go.
I need you to know I'm still alive.
And this is probably one of my other favorite songs on the record. I really like this one. Slowing things down a little bit. It's more of a mellow tune, kind of like Kaylin, but maybe not as poppy. You know, just
it's definitely a slow down song for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah.
I definitely like the song, but I appreciated them more for the upbeat stuff and the, and the killer riffs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This was a good song, but again, not one of my favorites. Our opinions differ on this one.
Hmm.
And they didn't do anything wrong. It's not you. It's me. Unwritten law. Not you. It's me. I get it. It's okay.
Oh, you know, it's not you. It's me. They're not buying it, Wayne.
That's not your fault that I'm not into you. The song.
No, I get it though. You like kind of like the more driving stuff. I mean, I think I like this one just because maybe it is a little breather on the record.
Yeah, it definitely changes up the tempo for sure. And I mean that makes the contrast all that much more for the other songs.
Yeah. But it's very melodic. I mean, even if you take out the words and you're just humming along, it's just got like a really great melody. It's kind of easy to follow along with.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with all that. I would agree with all that. But we're going up against a lot of other great songs on this album.
True.
Comparatively, it's for me, again, just me, it's probably not one of my favorite songs on the album. Just because it's going up against the other great, great, huge songs on here.
Yeah.
So I like it. It's a good song. I'll definitely be listening to it when it comes on. But,
yeah,
you know.
but you're not putting this one on.
Splitting hairs. Now, if we're splitting hairs and listening to each song individually here.
Appreciate it as a standalone.
Right.
It's a song about leaving, whether it be on a trip or the person is dying. I think it can be interpreted any way you want, really. But it's not about him leaving. It's about what's being left behind, which I always really kind of appreciated. You know, he wants the people that he's leaving behind to remember him, to remember the good times. You know, he doesn't want people to be sad. You know, the part that makes me think it's about death is obviously the, I need you to know I'm still alive in you. It's my time to go. Don't stay up. I'm not afraid. You're not afraid of death. It's kind of like a nice message of cherish the good times, cherish my life. I'm always going to be a part of who you are, even when I'm gone. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Make me feel bad for not liking the song as much.
Well, that's my job here on the Talking Records podcast, is to browbeat people into thinking my way. No.
Maybe you're right. I guess it is my favorite song on the album.
I submit. Have you heard the Music in High Places acoustic version that they did?
No, I have not.
Oh, that's a good version too. It opens up the special that they did at Yellowstone Park. You know, the one that was supposed to be Jimmy Eat World, but the company contacted the wrong management team and got Unwritten Law instead. Amazing story, by the way. We don't have time to go into all that.
I know that story. I don't know anything about
that.
Yeah,
so they're in this special where they're playing live music across Yellowstone. But yeah, this is a really nice version on that record. The record closes down with Genocide. Do you think you really wanna play? Cause we do this every fucking day. And we're gonna lay down the law. And you're out done. Well, let's go outside, we'll crucify and this song opens with a sweet guitar lead. The lyrics, though, this song. So we mentioned earlier about how kind of Sorry is a bit cringe. To me, this song is super cringe. It's like a boast. You know, it's like rap lyrics, like, come at us, we're gonna throw you down. You know, we're gonna lay down the law. You know, the city's got my back.
The whole city got my back.
The line, because you know, UL is 5-0, toe to toe, and that shit is for real. I mean, I'm like, are these guys being serious? Is this like this can't be real.
So tough.
Yeah. I don't know. Who am I? Yeah, I don't know. But it's kind of a bummer because I kind of like the final song on the record to be a really good one, a real strong close. And I kind of feel, I mean, I know there's a secret track and maybe we can count that as the end of the record. But for me, like end of record proper, it kind of ends on kind of a low note.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little weird, you know, to have, you know, songs like Holiday and then Genocide is like,
yeah,
on the right, I'm like, oh,
life's okay. A holiday. Well, you're all gonna die.
Well, that's cool. We're bipolar. That's fine. That's fine. You are who you are. You know.
Yeah.
But it's just, it is weird when you're, you know, trying to have. Again, the cohesiveness comes from the way it was all put together musically, not necessarily lyrically,
mm-hmm.
or theme wise or anything like that. And maybe going back to how we started this conversation about why they didn't hit it big is because maybe they didn't have that continuity of a connection with their fan base to be like, are we angry about stuff? Are we happy and appreciative about stuff? Give me one of those. Okay, I can't do both. Can't be angry about clapping because life's a holiday or having my whole city beat up the person that doesn't believe in whatever I'm spitting here.
Yeah, maybe you might be onto something.
but again, it like you said, it not the best way to end the album. A little Yabro meatheady type lyrics,
yeah,
kind of thing going on there. But again, cool riffs, still catchy, even though.
But just not like a strong lyrics, closer. I mean, I feel like by the time this song comes on, I'm like fishing through my CDs to get the next one ready to go in, and I'm hitting the eject button before
you don't listen to the end track there. You don't listen to the secret one.
What? I've only heard the secret track maybe a handful of times, although I do like it, but you know,
it's a whole song.
Yeah, we can get into this, but like the whole secret track thing, like it was annoying to wait for it. It was annoying to fast forward to it. It was annoying when
how deep was it? I don't think it was that deep.
It's only
deep,
a few minutes, but Wayne, minutes. I'm an impatient man.
I thought it was a few seconds.
No, it's not a few seconds. Is it? Oh,
I thought it was like 10 seconds in, then it starts or something.
Well, you and I have a very different concept of time, and that has been made clear by the many years we played in the same band together.
Well, and even before we started recording, you were like, it's been a cup full of Cadbury.
I ate all my Cadbury eggs before you even came on here.
I ate all my cream eggs before you came on. I was like, oh, that's how you measure time. Okay.
I absolutely measure time by food. You don't?
I mean, I could see that. I could definitely associate with that.
I'll be there in an apple and a half.
Right, right, right. I was like, oh, I know exactly how long that is. Huh.
So there's a secret track, 418. This song kicks off with some drums and a didgeridoo. Remember when you had that didgeridoo in college?
What? I still have it.
You still have it?
I'm going to go get it. I'll get it right now. I'm going to get it right now. I love whipping that thing out.
Why don't you have it on display in the background there? Huh? Why don't you have it on display in the background there?
I do. I have it upstairs. It's right next to right in the living room. So I can just whip that thing out of the corner.
Yeah. So apparently Incubus vocalist Brandon Boyd is doing the spoken word part on this and rocking the didgeridoo. Incubus guitarist Mike Enziger is also on there, probably playing some guitar and kind of cool. Incubus. Yeah. Were you an Incubus band?
I wonder how did that come about? Well, they're from California too, right?
Yeah, they're on Epic, so maybe they met through their time at Epic.
Maybe they're pandering to their Australian audience.
Oh, absolutely. You think so?
Euro zero, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
It's a cool song. It's a little too out there for the album proper, but it works great as a secret track.
Yeah, I'm a little cringy on that father part. I think it was just because of that. Mm. There were so many different, like, it's definitely part of that era, late 90s, you know, even in the metal scene and stuff like that, to have like an angry father song.
Mm, yeah.
It's kind of like a thing in that era. So
the old father tripe.
Right. So I was kind of like, yeah. Yeah. So it's a little bit of an eye roll, but.
Mm. But other than that, it's kind of cool. It's experimental. I mean, you always got to bury your weird stuff. In the secret track.
Bury your weird stuff.
But I actually think it's pretty cool. Like I said earlier, I haven't really heard it that many times because secret tracks for me are just like, I don't know, they're hard to get to. But
I don't know,
they're
man.
Not hard to get to.
It was all right. I mean, I thought it was like, you know, almost a legit song. It wasn't as secret tracky as a lot of them are, which is just total obscurity. Just to be like, stuff, what are they? What is this? Mm-hmm. Why did they even have it? Who's spending money on this?
I know. If it's not someone just joking around, it's like some 7 minute long like instrument. It's like, what?
Yeah.
They spent studio time on this?
Right,
mixing
exactly.
This and everything? But I mean, this is an actual song, so I guess it's all right.
You guess it's all right. It's my favorite song on the album. No, it's not. No, it's not. Why is it called 418? Is that how long the track is? Is 4:18?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. I did not.
Is that like the area code for where they're from?
It's
got to
be code for something. A police call, or maybe it's a coffin text related thing. I don't know.
It was a what?
A coffin text related thing. I have no idea.
Oh, maybe.
Or maybe it's just the time stamp. I don't know. You're right. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe they just finished doing it at 4:18 p.m. or something.
And that's a wrap time. 4:18.
4:20. I don't know.
Yeah. All right, so moving really quickly into the artwork for this record, there's not a whole lot to say about the record appearance-wise. It's all black, you know.
I think that's the idea, is simplicity.
Yeah,
I think it's,
hence
you know,
the black album title.
But super straightforward, right.
It does have the small white sphinx in the middle there, which is kind of cool. It relates to the Coffin Text.
Brandon
thing.
Fraser movies, yep.
The graphic design work was done by Lorna Turner. Not really much to say about the packaging. You said it kind of came in like a slip. The CD came in kind of like a slip.
Yeah, it was case. Like a fold out, you know, soft case. So it was like cardstock that, you know, opened up and
cool.
it looked different than just a jewel CD case and stuff. So,
yeah.
You know, that was standout-ish.
It never came out on vinyl except for years ago. SRC Vinyl did like their own press of the record on white vinyl. It's pretty cool looking. I never got one, but
it was on white vinyl.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. White vinyl on a black album.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, not a whole lot there. So in closing, Unwritten Law never emerged as one of the big name punk bands signed to a major. Something just didn't catch on. Whether it be the songs, the band's look, the promotion, who knows? Why do certain things make explosive impressions on people and other things just don't? In my opinion, this record is way better than some of the stuff that went mega huge at that time. There's no accounting for taste in this world. This record is just a well-executed batch of accessible songs. The album benefits from Rick Parashar's production and the band's willingness to branch out a little and work towards setting themselves apart from the throngs of other bands found on skate videos. Wayne, this is a band that I pair with you because not only did I hear them for the first time through you, but we spent a lot of time listening to this and then later Elva, like we mentioned at the start. Just
yep.
A lot of good times, man, listening to this record.
I still can't believe I opened the door for you to listen to Unwritten Law.
That's right, man.
I just can't believe that.
It was all you.
The first time that I've heard about that.
It's all you.
All me. Yep.
I mean, it was either this or Candiria.
Candiria or some sort of deathcore band that made your ears bleed.
Yep.
I could not find it. When we said we originally wanted to do this, you know, podcast, and this is a common album that we were both, you know, pretty jazzed about, I couldn't find it. Like, I literally know I had it, know I downloaded it, you know, from the CD, you know, ripped it on the computer and saved it, but I don't know what happened to it. So I had to actually rebuy it.
Oh.
And it was very worth it.
Nice.
I will listen to it more and, yeah, it was totally worth it. I mean, like, it was a good album, and unfortunately, yeah, it kind of got lost in the shuffle, I guess. I have no idea why. It hit many check marks for me.
It's funny how an album will mean so much to you, and then you'll step away from it for a while, but then when you put it back on, man, it's like you're right back in it.
Yeah. Yep. It totally did.
Well, Wayne, I would like to thank you so much for hanging out with me tonight and going through Unwritten Law's self-titled record. This was a lot of fun, man.
Oh, man, thanks for having me. I really appreciate doing all these with you and get to revisit these albums again, you know, under the microscope.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, like I always say, you know, we had so many of these conversations throughout the years about music, you know, riding out to shows or hanging out together. And it's like, it totally makes sense now to, you know, just stick some microphones in front of our faces and get it all recorded, you know?
That's right. That's right. Use these microphones for something else other than making fart noises and putting an echo on there. That's a lot of band practice right there.
That's mostly band practice.
I was going to say that's probably 65 to 75% of the band practice. Fart noises.
I would like to thank Chris DeMakes from Less Than Jake for the theme music, and I would like to thank each and every one of you listeners. Thanks for checking out Talking Records. It is so much fun to connect with friends, connect with artists, connect with new friends, connect with music fans all around about all these records that we love so much, chat about the songs, you know, try to gather up everything we can about the records so that we can learn something new about them and have it all in one place. Searching the vast internet for interviews and videos and trying to learn about the stuff can be really challenging sometimes. So it's fun to kind of collect it all and put it here. Definitely check us out on the socials. Please say hello. Suggest albums. Tell us your stories. How did you get into Unwritten Law? All right. Wayne, it's been real, man.
Yeah, thanks again, man. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks for hanging out. We'll get together and play Didgeridoo sometime soon.
Oh, can't wait. I'll tune that thing up. The spread is too bready.